Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 104. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you The Coins of Dionysius by Ernest Brammer, narrated by Jay Longyans. Ernest Brammer, born Ernest Brammer Smith on the 20th of March, 1868, was an English author of short stories and magazine features. Very poor grades at school led him initially into a career as a farmer, but when that failed spectacularly, he turned his burgeoning interest in literature into a series of diverse editing and writing jobs. His humorous works were ranked with Jerome K. Jerome, whom he worked for as a secretary and later an editor. His detective stories were compared to Conan Doyle's, with his Max Carrados stories appearing alongside Doyle's Sherlock Holmes in the Strand magazine. Even his politico-science fiction is compared to that of H.G. Wells, and George Orwell acknowledges that Brammer's book What Might Have Been influenced his 1984. He died at 74, a successful author, having a knowledge of chemistry, physics, law, philosophy, the classics, literature, the occult, and ordnance, and being an expert in a branch of numismatics. Jay Longyans is first and foremost a co-host and content creator for newfictionwriters.com. He's also an aspiring author whose work can be seen at that website too. He also has a small segment on flashpulp.com where he reviews audiobooks, and because of all this, he's also now a voiceover artist and always looking for work. He lives in Airdrie, Alberta, Canada, with his wife and two kids. So remember, you've never found anything in your small change as strange as The Coin of Dionysius by Ernest Brammer, narrated by Jay Longyans.
It was 8 o'clock at night and raining, scarcely a time when a business so limited in its clientele as that of a coin dealer could hope to attract any customer. But a light was still showing in the small shop that bore over its window the name of Baxter, and in the even smaller office at the back, the proprietor himself sat reading the latest Pall Mall. His enterprise seemed to be justified, for presently the doorbell gave its announcement, and throwing down his paper, Mr. Baxter went forward. As a matter of fact, the dealer had been expecting someone, and his manner, as he passed into the shop, was unmistakably suggestive of a caller of importance. But at first glance towards his visitor, the excess of deference melted out of his bearing, leaving the urbane, self-possessed shopman in the presence of a casual customer.
"Mr. Baxter, I think," said the latter.
He had laid aside his dripping umbrella and was unbuttoning his overcoat and coat to reach an inner pocket.
"You hardly remember me, I suppose. Mr. Carlyle, 2 years ago I took up a case for you."
"To be sure, Mr. Carlyle, the private detective."
"Inquiry agent,"
corrected Mr. Carlyle precisely.
"Well," said Mr. Baxter, "for that matter, I am a coin dealer, and not an antiquarian or a numeralist. Is there anything in that way that I can do for you?"
"Yes," replied his visitor. "It is my turn to consult you."
He had taken a small wash leather bag from his inner pocket and now turned something carefully out upon the counter.
"What can you tell me about that?"
The dealer gave the coin a moment of scrutiny.
"There is no question about this," he replied. "It's a Sicilian pterodactyl of Dionysus."
"Yes, I know that. I have it on the label out of the cabinet. I can further tell you that it's supposed to be one that Lord Seastroke gave £250 for at a price sale in 94.
"It seems to me that you could tell me more about it than I could tell you," remarked Mr. Baxter. "What is it that you really want to know?"
"I want to know," replied Mr. Carlyle, "whether it's genuine or not."
"Has any doubt been cast upon it?"
"Certain circumstances raise a suspicion, that is all."
The dealer took another look at the pterodactyl through his magnifying glass, holding it by its edge with a careful touch of an expert. Then he shook his head slowly in confession of ignorance.
"Of course, I could make a guess."
"No, don't,"
interrupted Mr. Carlyle hastily.
"An arrest hangs on it, and nothing short of certainty is any good to me."
"Is that so, Mr. Carlyle?"
said Mr. Baxter, with increased interest.
"Well, to be quite candid, the thing is out of my line. Now, if it was a rare Saxton penny, or a doubtful noble, I'd stake my reputation on my opinion. But I do very little in the classic series."
Mr. Carlyle did not attempt to conceal his disappointment as he returned the coin to the bag and replaced the bag in the inner pocket.
"I have been relying on you,"
he crumbled reproachfully.
"Where on earth am I to go now?"
"There is always the British Museum."
"Ah, to be sure, thanks. But will anyone who can tell me be there now?"
"No fear," replied Mr. Baxter. "Go round in the morning."
"But I must know tonight,"
explained the visitor, reducing to despair again.
"Tomorrow will be too late for the purpose."
Mr. Baxter did not hold out much encouragement in the circumstances.
"You can scarcely expect to find anyone at business now,"
he remarked.
"I should have been gone these 2 hours myself, only I happened to have an appointment with an American millionaire who fixed his own time."
Something indistinguishable from a wink slid off Mr. Baxter's right eye.
"Offmusen, he's called, and a bright young pedigree hunter, has traced his descent from Offa, King of Marseille. So he, quite naturally, wants a set of offers, as a sort of collateral proof."
"Very interesting,"
murmured Mr. Carlyle, fidgeting with his watch.
"I should love an hour's chat with you about your millionaire customers. Some other time. Just now, look here, Baxter, can't you give me a line of introduction to some dealer in this sort of thing, who happens to live in town? You must know dozens of experts."
"Why, bless my soul, Mr. Carlyle, I don't know a man of them away from his business,"
said Mr. Baxter, staring.
"They may live in Park Lane, or they may live in Petticoat Lane, for all I know. Besides, there aren't so many experts as you seem to imagine, and the two best will very likely quarrel over it. You've had to do with expert witnesses, I suppose?"
"I don't want witnesses. There will be no need to give evidence. All I want is an absolute authoritative pronouncement that I can count on. Is there no one who can really say whether the thing is genuine or not?"
Mr. Baxter's meaning silence became cynical in its implication as he continued to look at his visitor across the counter. Then he relaxed.
"Stay a bit. There is a man, an amateur. I remember hearing wonderful things about some time ago. They say he really does know."
"There you are,"
exclaimed Mr. Carlyle, much relieved.
"There always is someone. Who is he?"
"Funny name,"
replied Mr. Baxter.
"Something Win, or Win something."
He craned his neck to catch a sight of an important motor car that was drawing to the curb before his window.
"Win Cardos! You'll excuse me now, Mr. Carlyle, won't you? This looks like Mr. Offmusen."
Mr. Carlyle hastily scribbled the name down on his cuff.
"Win Cardos, right. Where does he live?"
"Haven't the remotest idea,"
replied Mr. Baxter, referring the arrangement of his tie to the judgment of the wall mirror.
"I have never seen the man myself. Now, Mr. Carlyle, I'm sorry. I can't do any more for you. You won't mind, will you?"
Mr. Carlyle could not pretend to misunderstand. He enjoyed the distinction of holding open the door for the transatlantic representative of the line of Offa as he went out, and then made his way through the muddy streets back to his office. There was only one way of tracing a private individual, at such short notice, through the pages of the directories, and the gentleman did not flatter himself by a very high esteem of his chances. Fortune favoured him, however. He very soon discovered a Win Cardos living at Richmond, and, better still, further search failed to unearth another. There was apparently only one householder at all events of that name in the neighbourhood of London. He jotted down the address and set out for Richmond. The house was some distance from the station, Mr. Carlyle learned. He took a taxicab and drove. Dismissing the vehicle at the gate, he prided himself on his power of observation and the accuracy of deductions which result from it. A detail of his business.
"It's nothing more than using one's eye and putting two and two together,"
he would modestly declare, when he wished to be depreciatory rather than impressive. By the time he had reached the front door of the Turrets, he had formed some opinion of the position and task of the man who lived there. A manservant admitted Mr. Carlyle and took his card, his private card, with the bare request for an interview that would not detain Mr. Cardos for 10 minutes. Luck still favoured him. Mr. Cardos was at home and would see him at once. The servant, the hall through which they passed, and the room to which he was shown, all contributed something to the deductions which the quietly observant gentleman was half-unconsciously recording.
"Mr. Carlyle,"
announced the servant. The room was a library or a study. The only occupant, a man of about Carlyle's own age, had been using a typewriter up to the moment of his visitor's entrance. He now turned and stood up, and, with an expression of formal courtesy,
"It is very good of you to see me at this hour," apologized the caller.
The conventional expression of Mr. Cardos's face changed little.
"Surely my man has got your name wrong," he exclaimed. "Isn't it Lewis Carling?"
The visitor stopped short, and his agreeable smile gave place to a sudden flash of anger or annoyance.
"No, sir," he replied stiffly. "My name is on the card which you have before you."
"I beg your pardon," said Mr. Cardos, with the perfect good humour. "I hadn't seen it, but I used to know a Carling some years ago at St. Michael's."
"St. Michael's?"
Mr. Carling's features underwent another change, no less instant and sweeping than before.
"St. Michael's! Wynne Cardos! Good heavens! It isn't Max Wynne, old winning Wynne!"
"A little older and a little fatter, yes," replied Cardos. "I've changed my name, you see."
"Extraordinary thing meeting like this,"
said his visitor, dropping into a chair and staring at Mr. Cardos.
"I have changed more than my name. How did you recognize me?"
"The voice," replied Cardos. "It took me back to that little smoke-dried attic den of yours where we—"
"My God!"
exclaimed Carlyle bitterly.
"Don't remind me of what we are going to do in those days."
He looked around the well-furnished, handsome room and recalled the other signs of wealth that he had noticed.
"At all events, you seem fairly comfortable, Wynne."
"I am alternatively envied and pitied,"
replied Cardos, with a placid tolerance of circumstance that seemed characteristic of him.
"Still, as you say, I'm fairly comfortable."
"Envied? I can understand. But why pitied?"
"Because I'm blind,"
was the tranquil reply.
"Blind?"
exclaimed Mr. Carlyle, using his own eyes superlatively.
"Do you mean literally blind?"
"Literally. I was riding along a bridle path through a wood about a dozen years ago with a friend. He was in front, and at one point a twig sprung back. You know how easily things like that happens. It just flicked my eye. Nothing to think twice about."
"And that blinded you?"
"Yes, ultimately. It's called amaurosis."
"I can scarcely believe it. You seem so sure and self-reliant. Your eyes are full of expression. Only a little quieter than they used to be. I believe you were typing when I came in. Aren't you having me?"
"You miss the dog and stick," replied Cardos. "No, it's a fact."
"What an awful infliction for you, Max. You were always such an impulsive, reckless sort of fellow. Never quiet. You must miss such a fearful lot."
"Has anyone recognized you?"
asked Cardos quietly.
"Ah, that was the voice, you said," replied Carlyle.
"Yes, but other people heard the voice as well. Only I had no blundering, self-confident eyes to be hoodwinked."
"That's a rum way of putting it,"
said Carlyle.
"Are your ears never hoodwinked, may I ask?"
"Not now, nor any of my other senses that have to look out for themselves."
"Well, well,"
muttered Mr. Carlyle, cut short in his sympathetic emotions.
"I'm glad you take it so well, of course, if you find it an advantage to be blind, old man."
He stopped and reddened.
"I beg your pardon,"
he concluded stiffly.
"Not an advantage, perhaps,"
replied the other thoughtfully.
"Still, it has its compensations that one might not think of. A new world to explore, new experiences, new powers awakening, strange new perceptions, life in the fourth dimension.
But why do you beg my pardon, Louise?" "I'm an ex-solicitor, struck off in connection with falsifying of a trust account, Mr. Cardos,"
replied Carlyle, rising.
"Sit down, Louise,"
said Cardos suavely. His face, even his incredibly living eyes, beamed placid good nature.
"The chair on which you sit, the roof above you, all the comfortable surroundings to which you have so amiably alluded, are the direct result of falsifying a trust account. But do I call you Mr. Carlyle in consequence? Certainly not, Louise."
"I did not falsify the account,"
cried Carlyle hotly. He sat down, however, and added more quietly,
"But why do I tell you all this? I have never spoken of it before."
"Blindness invites confidence,"
replied Cardos.
We are out of the running. The human rivalry ceases to exist. Besides, why shouldn't you? In my case, the account was falsified.
Of course, that's all bumpkin, Max, commented Carlyle. Still, I appreciate your motive.
Practically everything I possess was left to me by an American cousin, on the condition that I took the name of Cardos. He made his fortune by an ingenious conspiracy of doctoring the crop reports and unloading favorably in consequence, and I need hardly remind you that the receiver is equally as guilty as the thief.
But twice as safe. I know something of that, Max. Have you any idea what my business is?
You shall tell me, replied Cardos.
I'd run a private inquiry agency. When I lost my profession, I had to do something for a living. This occurred. I dropped my name, changed my appearance, and opened an office. I knew the legal side down to the ground, and I got a retired Scotland Yard man to organize the outside work.
Excellent, replied Cardos. Do you unearth any murders?
No, admitted Mr. Carlyle. Our business lies mostly on the conventional lines among divorce and defalcation.
That's a pity, remarked Cardos. Do you know, Louis, I always had a secret ambition to be a detective myself. I've even thought lately that I might still be able to do something at it if the chance came my way. What makes you smile?
Well, certainly the idea.
Yes, the idea of a blind detective, blind tracking the alert.
Of course, as you say, certain faculties are no doubt quickened.
Mr. Carlyle hastened to add considerately.
But seriously, with the exception of an artist, I don't suppose there is any man who is more utterly dependent on his eyes.
Whatever opinion Cardos might have held privately, his genial exterior did not betray a shadow of dissent. For a full minute he continued to smoke as though he derived an actual visual enjoyment from the blue sprays that travelled and dispersed across the room. He had already placed before his visitor a box containing cigars of a brand which that gentleman keenly appreciated, but generally regarded as unattainable, and the matter-of-fact ease and certainty with which the blind man had brought the box and put it before him had sent a questioning flicker through Carlyle's mind.
"You used to be rather fond of art yourself, Louise," he remarked presently. "Give me your opinion of my latest purchase, the bronze lion on the cabinet there."
Then, as Carlyle's gaze went about the room, he added quickly,
"No, not that cabinet, the one on your left."
Carlyle shot a sharp glance at his host as he got up, but Cardos's expression was merely benignly complacent. Then he strolled across to the figure.
"Very nice," he admitted. "Late Flemish, isn't it?"
"No, it's a copy of Vidal's Roaring Lion."
"Vidal?"
"A French artist."
The voice became indescribably flat.
He also had the misfortune to be blind, by the way.
You old humbug, Max, shrieked Carlyle. You've been thinking that out for the last 5 minutes.
Then the unfortunate man bit his lip and turned his back towards his host.
Do you remember how we used to pile it up on that obtuse ass Sanders and then roast him?
Asked Cardos, ignoring the half-smothered exclamation with which the other man had recalled himself.
Yes,
replied Carlyle quietly.
"This is very good,"
he continued, addressing himself to the bronze again.
"However did he do it?"
"With his hands."
"Naturally. But I mean, how did he study his model?"
"Also with his hands. He called it seeing near."
"Even with a lion? Handled it?"
"In such cases he required the services of a keeper, who brought the animal to bay while Vidal exercised his own particular gifts. You don't feel inclined to put me on a track of a mystery, Louis?"
Unable to regard this request as anything but one of old Max's unquenchable pleasantries, Mr. Carlyle was on the point of making a suitable reply when a sudden thought caused him to smile knowingly. Up to that point he had, indeed, completely forgotten the object of his visit. Now he remembered the doubtful Dionysus and Mr. Baxter's recommendation. He immediately assumed that some mistake had been made. Either Max was not the Wynn Cardos that he had been seeking, or else the dealer had been misinformed. For, although his host was wonderfully expert in the face of his misfortune, it was inconceivable that he could decide the genuineness of a coin without seeing it. The opportunity seemed a good one of getting even with Cardos, by taking him at his word.
"Yes,"
he accordingly replied, with crisp deliberation as he crossed the room.
"Yes, I will, Max. Here's a clue to what seems to be a rather remarkable fraud."
He put the pterodactyl into his host's hand.
"What do you make of it?"
For a few seconds, Cardos handled the piece with a delicate manipulation of his fingertips, while Carlyle looked on with a self-appreciative grin. Then, with equal gravity, the blind man weighed the coin in the balance of his hand. Finally, he touched it with his tongue.
"Well?" demanded the other.
"Of course, I have not much to go on, and if I was more fully in your confidence, I might come to another conclusion."
"Yes, yes,"
interposed Carlyle with amused encouragement.
"Then I should advise you to arrest the parlourmaid, Nina Brune. Communicate with the police authorities of Padua for the particulars of a career of Helen Bruinsey, and suggest to Lord Seastroke that he should return to London to see what further depredations have been made in his cabinet."
Mr. Carlyle's groping hand sought for the chair, on which he dropped blankly. His eyes were unable to detach themselves for a single moment from the very ordinary spectacle of Mr. Cardos's mildly benevolent face. While the sterilized ghost of his now-forgotten amusement still lingered about his features,
"Good heavens!"
he managed to articulate.
"How do you know?"
"Isn't that what you wanted of me?"
asked Cardos suavely.
"Don't humbug, Max,"
said Carlyle severely.
"This is no joke."
An unidentified mistrust of his own powers suddenly possessed him in the presence of this mystery.
"How do you come to know of Nina Brune and Lord Seastroke?"
"You are the detective, Luis," replied Cardos. "How does one know of these things? By using one's eyes and putting two and two together."
Carlyle groaned and flung out an arm perpetually.
"Is it all bumpkin, Max? Do you really see all the time? Though that doesn't go very far towards explaining it."
"Like Vidal, I see very well, at close quarters,"
replied Cardos, lightly running a forefinger along the inscription on the pterodactyl.
"For longer range, I keep another pair of eyes. Would you like to test them?"
Mr. Carlyle's assent was not very gracious. It was, in fact, faintly sulky. He was suffering the annoyance of feeling distinctly unimpressive in his own department, but he was also curious.
"The bell is just behind you, if you don't mind," said his host. "Parkinson will appear. You might take note of him while he is in."
The man who had admitted Mr. Carlyle proved to be Parkinson.
"This gentleman is Mr. Carlyle, Parkinson,"
explained Cardos the moment the man entered.
"You will remember him for the future."
Parkinson's apologetic eye swept the visitor from head to toe, but so lightly and swiftly that it conveyed to that gentleman the comparison of being deftly dusted.
"I will endeavour to do so, sir,"
replied Parkinson, turning again to his master.
"I shall be at home to Mr. Carlyle whenever he calls. That is all."
"Very well, sir."
"Now, Luis,"
remarked Mr. Cardos briskly, when the door had closed again,
"you have had a good opportunity of studying Parkinson. What is he like?"
"In what way?"
"I mean, as a matter of description. I'm a blind man. I haven't seen my servant for 12 years. What idea can you give me of him? I ask you to notice."
"I know you did, but Parkinson is the sort of man who has very little about him to describe. He is the embodiment of the ordinary. His height is about average."
5'9", murmured Cardos. "Slightly above the mean."
"Scarcely noticeably so. Clean-shaven, medium brown hair, no particularly marked features, dark eyes, good teeth."
"False. The teeth, not the statement."
"Possibly," admitted Carlyle. "I am not a dental expert. I had no opportunity of examining Mr. Parkinson's mouth in detail. But what is the drift of all of this?"
"His clothes?"
"Oh, just the ordinary evening dress of a valet. Not much room for variety in that."
"You notice, in fact, nothing special by which Parkinson could be identified?"
"Well, he wore an unusually broad gold band on the little finger of his left hand."
"But that is removable, and yet Parkinson has an ineradicable mole, a small one, I admit, on his chin, and you a human sleuth-hound. Oh, Luis!"
"At all events,"
retorted Carlyle, writhing a little under the good-humoured satire, although it is easy enough to see it in Cardos's affectionate intention.
"At all events, I dare say I can give as good a description of Parkinson as he can give of me."
"That is what we are going to test. Ring the bell again."
"Seriously?"
"Quite. I am trying my eyes against yours. If I can't give you 50 out of 100, I will renounce my private detectorial ambitions forever."
"It isn't quite the same,"
objected Carlyle, but he rang the bell.
"Come in, close the door, Parkinson," said Cardos when the man appeared. Don't look at Mr. Carlyle again. In fact, you had better stand with your back towards him. He won't mind. Now, describe to me his appearance as you observed it."
Parkinson tendered his respectful apologies to Mr. Carlyle for the liberty he was compelled to take by the deferential quality of his voice.
"Mr. Carlyle, sir, wears patent leather boots of about a size 7, very little used. There are 5 buttons, but on the left boot 1 button, the 3rd up, is missing, leaving loose threads and not the more usual metal fastener. Mr. Carlyle's trousers, sir, are of a dark material, a dark grey line of about 1/4 inch width on the darker ground. The bottoms are turned permanently up and are, just now, a little muddy, if I may say so."
"Very muddy," interposed Mr. Carlyle generously. "It's a wet night, Parkinson."
"Yes, sir. Very unpleasant weather. If you will allow me, sir, I will brush you in the hall. The mud is dry now, I notice."
"Then, sir," continued Parkinson, reverting to the business at hand, "there are dark green cashmere hose, a curb pattern keychain, passes into the left-hand trouser pocket." From the visitor's nether garments, the photogenic-eyed Parkinson proceeded to higher ground, and with increasing wonder Mr. Carlyle listened to the faithful catalogue of his possessions. His fetter and ink albert of gold and platinum was minutely described. His spotted blue ascot, with its gentlemanly pearl scarfpin, was set forth, and the fact that the buttonhole in the left lapel of his morning coat showed that signs of use was duly noted. What Parkinson saw he recorded, but he made no deductions. A handkerchief carried in the cuff of his right sleeve was simply that to him, and not an indication that Mr. Carlyle was, indeed, left-handed. But a more delicate part of Parkinson's undertaking remained. He approached it with a double cough.
"As regards to Mr. Carlyle's personal appearance, sir?"
"No, enough!"
cried the gentleman concerned hastily.
"I am more than satisfied. You are a keen observer, Parkinson."
I have trained myself to suit my master's requirements, sir," replied the man.
He looked towards Mr. Cardos, received a nod, and withdrew. Mr. Carlyle was the first to speak.
"That man of yours will be worth £50 a week to me, Max,"
he remarked thoughtfully.
"But of course—"
"I don't think he would take it,"
replied Cardos in a voice of equally detached speculation.
"He suits me very well, but you have a chance of using his services indirectly."
"You still mean that? Seriously?"
"I notice in you a chronic disinclination to take me seriously, Louise. It is really, to an Englishman, almost painful. Is there something inherently comic about me or the atmosphere of the turrets?"
"No, my friend," replied Mr. Carlyle. "But there is something essentially preposterous. That is what points to the improbable. Now what is it?"
"It may be merely a whim, but it is more than that," replied Cardos. "It is, well, partly vanity, partly ennui, partly—"
Certainly there was something more, nearly tragic in his voice than comic now.
"Partly hope."
Mr. Carlyle was too tactful to pursue the subject.
"Those are 3 tolerable motives,"
he acquiesced.
"I will do anything you want, Max, on one condition."
"Agreed. And it is?"
"That you tell me how you knew so much of this affair."
He tapped the silver coin which lay on the table near them.
"I am not easily flabbergasted," he added.
"You won't believe that there's nothing to explain, that it was purely second sight?"
"No,"
replied Carlyle tersely.
"I won't."
"You are quite right, and yet the thing's very simple."
"They always are, when you know,"
soliloquized the other.
"That is what makes them so confoundedly difficult when you don't."
"Here is this one, then. In Padua, which seems to be regaining its old reputation as the birthplace of suspicious antiques, by the way, there lives an ingenious craftsman by the name of Pietro Steli. This simple soul, who possesses a talent not inferior to that of carving at his best, has for many years turned his hand to the not unprofitable occupation of forging rare Greek and Roman coins. As a collector and a student of certain Greek colonials, and a specialist in forgeries, I have been familiar with the Steli's workmanship for years. Lately, he seems to have come under the influence of an international crook called, at the moment, Dom Pierre, who soon saw a way of utilizing Steli's genius on a royal scale. Helen Brunsi, who in private life, and really is, I believe, Madame Dom Pierre, readily lent her services to the enterprise."
"Quite so,"
nodded Mr. Carlyle as his host paused.
"You see the whole sequence, of course?"
"Not exactly. Not in detail,"
confessed Mr. Carlyle.
Dampierre's idea was to gain access to some of the most celebrated cabinets of Europe and substitute Stelli's fabrications for the genuine coins. The princely collection of rarities that he would thus amass might be difficult to dispose of safely, but I have no doubt that he had matured his plans. Helen, in the person of Nina Braun, an anglicized French parlourmaid, a part which she fills to perfection, was to obtain wax impressions of the most valuable pieces and to make the exchange when the counterfeits reached her. In this way, it was obviously hoped that the fraud would not come to light until long after the real coins had been sold, and I gather that she has already done her work successfully in several houses. Then, impressed by her excellent references and capable manner, my housekeeper engaged her, and for a few weeks she went about her duties here. It was fatal to the detail of this scheme. However, I have the misfortune to be blind. I am told that Helen has so innocently an angelic a face as to disarm suspicion, but I am incapable of being impressed, and that good material was thrown away. But one morning my material fingers, which, of course, knew nothing of Helen's angelic face, discovered an unfamiliar touch about the surface of my favourite Euclides, and, although there was doubtless nothing to be seen, my critical sense of smell reported that wax had been recently pressed against it. I began to make discreet inquiries, and in the meantime my cabinets went to the local bank for safety. Helen countered by receiving a telegram from Argiers, calling her to the deathbed of her aged mother. The aged mother succumbed. Duty compelled Helen to remain at the side of her stricken patriarchal father, and doubtless the turrets was written off the syndicate's operation as a bad debt.
"Very interesting," admitted Mr. Carlyle, "but at the risk of seeming obtuse."
His manner had become delicately chastened.
"I must say that I fail to trace the inevitable connection between Nina Brun and this particular forgery, assuming that it is a forgery."
"Set your mind at rest about that, Louise," replied Cardos. "It is a forgery, and it is a forgery that none but Pietro Stelli could have achieved. That is the essential connection. Of course, there are accessories. A private detective coming urgently to see me, with a notable pterodactyl in his pocket, which he announces to be the clue of a remarkable fraud. Well, really, Lewis, one scarcely needs to be blind to see through that."
"And Lord Seastroke, I suppose you happened to discover that Nina Brun had gone there?"
"No, I cannot claim to have discovered that, or I should certainly have warned him at once when I found out, only recently, about the gang. As a matter of fact, the last information I had of Lord Seastroke was a line in yesterday's Morning Post to the effect that he was still at Cairo, but many of these pieces..."
He brushed his fingers almost lovingly across the vivid chariot race that embellished the reverse of the coin, and broke off to remark,
"You really ought to take up the subject, Louise. You have no idea how useful it might prove to you some day."
"I really think I must," replied Carlyle grimly. £250 the original cost, I believe."
"Cheap, too. It would make £500 in New York today. As I was saying, many are literally unique. This gem by Chemo is..." Here is his signature, you see. Peter is particularly good at the lettering. "And as I handled the genuine pterodactyl about 2 years ago, when Lord Seastroke exhibited it at the meeting of our society in Albemarle Street, there is nothing at all wonderful in my being able to fix a locale of your mystery. Indeed, I feel that I should apologize for it all being so simple."
"I think," replied Mr. Carlyle,
critically examining the loose threads on his left boot,
"that the apology on that head would be more appropriate from me."
That was The Coin of Dionysius by Ernest Brammer, narrated by Jay Longyarns. Firstly, thanks to Jay for such a characterful narration. He previously read the Arthur Conan Doyle story The Lost Special for us back in episode 64. So much for not stereotyping our narrators. Everyone's heard of Lovecraft or Doyle, but I find it very interesting to compare the work they did against their peers of the day, say Clark Ashton Smith, or in this case Brammer. It's fascinating to explore what writing they inspired, or were inspired by, or to simply see another set of reactions to the events of the day. Sometimes, like Lovecraft's Circle, the work was highly collaborative, but it's easy to imagine Doyle and Brammer competing, trying to dream up ever more elaborate mysteries for their respective detectives to solve. What's your favourite pulp rivalry? leave a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com, or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrand. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 105, where we'll bring you a challenging new series of stories, The Sex Slaves of the Dragon Tongue, by F. Paul Wilson. Remember that your eyes may obscure as much as they reveal, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.